when all these very, very old, very sort of lame and old and creepy old ladies were all full of great personality. And it was the most extraordinary scene. And they all kind of rallied round. And they were all, I must say, the younger ones very, very well. I mean, they all instantly moved out of the seats and shoved them all up to the front. And but I mean, it was quite sort of moving in a way, seeing all these old ladies who obviously, I mean, coming out to a meeting in the evening in London, you know, at 6:30. It was a terrific effort for them.
Did they actually speak at the meeting?
Not many did. Mrs. Corbett Ashby made a statement which she said she couldn't speak because it was read out by Lady Sear. But mostly they, only one or two of them made a very short contribution. But there wasn't really all that much. I mean, most of it was, most of the speaking was done by the younger ones who were very vociferous. And by long statements from the executive, sort of defending themselves. You know.
What was the line the young people were taking then? I mean, they were on the side of the old ladies, kind of was.
They were really, you see, but they were, yeah, I think the thing was that they'd come, like people often do to meetings, they were a bit tersome, really, because they had thought that they weren't going to win, or that this was in doubt. They had realised that it was going to be carried absolutely overwhelmingly because all these old members had come out of their holes in order to vote, you see. But they sort of said, and a lot of them had come prepared with all kinds of arguments. I mean, there was one who was a lawyer who was really rather tiresome and produced all kinds of arguments about the legal situation of the various trusts and so on, which were really totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
And then they kept on asking sort of questions about, they asked about the Polytechnic's offer were quite to point in a way, but that they were rather sort of aggressive.
Yes.
and unnecessarily so, really. As though they thought they were going to have to fight, and then they didn't really quite know how to do the situation when it was discovered that they didn't really have to fight at all.
Because the whole thing was organised by a countrywide agitation in a way on the press and everywhere.
And you see, they were very annoyed too, because they thought that the kind of guillotine was being put on, which it was in a way, because I mean, it had been let out that Lady Sear had come out to dinner somewhere or something, and she was sort of presiding. And the young ones were annoyed about this. I mean, they were annoyed at her because they thought she was throwing the weight about, and they were determined to sort of prolong it, you know. And we, in the end, the elderly among us really did force a vote, because we could see that it was not necessary to go on with this. And then most of us got up and went. I mean, somebody moved that the vote be taken, and I leapt to my feet and said, as I have now got to go back to Oxford, I have to take it at once. There, that was quite startled. That quite startled these youngies who just dropped in from around the corner. Anyway, we did have the vote, but they went on talking long after that.
The atmosphere was tense and exciting, was it? I mean,
it was quite exciting, but it wasn't sort of a way. It was a foregone conclusion. I mean, you could tell that. I mean, I think the campaign had done it. You see, it really was putting a rubber stamp on. I mean, obviously the campaign had been much more. I mean, one hadn't really realised how many people had weighed in. I mean, the sort of clinching speech was made by a man, a professor.
McGregor,
yes. And he'd got a great sheaf of letters from all the principals of all the women's colleges in Turkey and everything. And he marshalled his stuff very well. I mean, he made quite a short speech, but it was very clinching. And really totally demolished the case, which in any case was pretty rocky. And then they had the London Polytechnic person. I can't really understand, because I mean, Nancy Sear used to be quite a sensible woman. I can't understand why she left herself to this plot. It was very peculiar.
I think maybe they just wanted to get rid of the library, and they just, you know, they took the first thing that came out in a way.
Yes, and then didn't like to go back in it, but I mean, that was silly, because I mean, they actually, one of the things that was read, the statement that was read from London School of Economics made it perfectly plain that they weren't dying to get the course. I mean, if a better offer came, they wouldn't be offended.
Did John Saville talk to the professor from Hull?
No, he didn't. Well, not while I was there.
I see. Yes. But it sounds like
think about ringing in a way, because it was rather wonderful seeing all these people coming out again, you know, and realising that they were still alive and still had their wits about them, even though they were a bit decrepit on their appearance.
Yes, well, because Dame Margaret Cordash is absolutely fantastic. I talked to her. They're not exactly questions, as separate points, really. I mean, did she ever talk much about the suffrage period to you? I mean, or was it something that was in the background? Was she sort of person always looking forward rather than looking back, would you say?
Basically, I think she tended to look forward. She did talk, I mean, she wasn't the sort of person who would sit and reminisce about the good old days like people have done about the war, like people attended or been in wars. I mean, she was more interested in the present and in what was going to happen. I mean, she would sometimes make, I mean, for instance, there was a thing she used to say, which, she used to say sometimes when people had sort of said things about suffragettes, that Mrs. Fawcett agreed with her view that although they never themselves have lent themselves to being suffragettes, I mean, they couldn't themselves brought themselves to liberate, break the law and do damage, but that they had serious doubts whether things would, you know, be even as good as they are now if it hadn't been for the suffragette. And they said they didn't think they would have done it on their own good. Although some people said that, well, maybe the war anyway would have managed it, you know. But she said they'd often had doubts as to whether it would have been enough, you know, what they were able to do.
Interesting, yes. I think it is to some extent a partnership between the two wings, in a way, in an odd sort of way.
Well, I think it was. I mean, I think what she felt was, you see, she felt very strongly about, and I mean, I think a lot of this is quite important too, a lot of the constitutional ones felt a little bit bad about, for instance, not being in prison and that kind of thing, because the others had suffered so much. And I mean, particularly with her religious view, I mean, she felt that sort of suffering was quite important.
So she did feel, in a sense, a slight guilty feeling.
She felt a slightly guilty feeling about that, and that was what made them do things that they didn't really like doing, like having demos and the Mud March and things like that. Mm-hmm.
So she, there's not a sort of bitterness against Mrs. Pankhurst or anything like that. Rather the reverse, if anything.
Rather the reverse.
Because, as you know, in the women's movement generally, between the wars, there is this sort of polarity still going on between the Fawcett Society types and the WSPU types.
Yes.
That still damages the women's movement long after.
It does, yes.
But it's interesting that she didn't take a sectarian position on that at all.
No, not really, no. I mean, she felt that she couldn't agree with them, possibly, she admired the courage and the determination that made them endure these sufferings and so on.
She was in the Church League, wasn't she, for
yes, some point? Yes.
Did that carry on to a general concern for women in the Church of England continuously after that? I mean,
yes, I think it did. She belonged to the Anglican Society for the Ordination of Women. And then there was all this with Lord Roy and so on. She used to try and indoctrinate my husband about this, and he was quite willing to listen to me because he was very liberal-minded in some ways. Though he didn't think that, he left the Anglican Society of the Ordination of Women later on because he thought that it was damaging the church in other ways. And he was rather torn. I mean, he was very keen on reunion with various other Christian bodies, you know. And various things used to get in the way.
Yes, I see.
But she did, I remember her talking to him about, but I think the thing about her was that, and I think probably about all those women was that most of them didn't have this sort of slightly sour anti-men thing, which tends to some of them, because they, it was all associated in their mind with a general desire for freedom and a general, a really intense feeling for liberty.
Which would apply to plenty of men, I suppose.
Yes, but I mean, they would have been just keen on it. She wasn't just as keen. I mean, she was terribly upset about the fascists. You know.
Was she?
Yes, and I remember once we, I remember talking about Salvemini, who had been imprisoned by, and also died in prison, you know, and how terribly much it was. Earlier on, before all this, you see, the whole family were tremendously worked up about Dreyfus. And they were on the side of the underdog, you know. I mean, her socialism was not at all Marxist insofar as she was a socialist. It was entirely because she felt that workers were having a raw deal.
Yes, sort of championing the underdog.
It was always championing the underdog, yes.
What about Ireland, actually? Was it Dunlop? Did that affect her at all? I mean, was she conscious of her Irish background?
It's funny, you know, because I don't remember sort of how that had been discussed.
Because it's not really an issue, is it, after about 1922, really? But it had been, of course, before then, very much an issue. I wondered if, you know, it had come up at all.
Yes, no, I don't thought of that, really, because in some ways they were proud of being an Irish family, they all were. She hadn't lived in Ireland. She had been brought up entirely away from Ireland. None of the family, in fact, the one who went back was after the Second World War, my cousin Owen, who was diplomat. Owen and Mayley, the last of the Mayleys, went back to live in County Mayo with his wife, who's Anne Bridge, who wrote all those books about. Do you know that?
No,
Well, she wrote a book called Peking Picnic, which is about being a diplomat in China, and then she wrote a whole series of novels, which are very, very popular.
So that really, when you talk about liberty, it wasn't Ireland that sprang to mind particularly, it was just the threat of fascism in Europe, where she'd be very much at one with Hammond, of course.
Yes, I mean, you see, she was, I don't think she was, we never went to, the only time we went to Ireland was that time when my father was there and we were there with him, but we never went to Ireland for holiday, it was always Europe. I suppose she would have felt quite strongly about it when it was happening, but it somehow just didn't seem to crop up.
What about the Spanish Civil War? That's late, of course, isn't it?
Yes, well, there, I mean, she was tremendously anti-Franco. Very upset about it. And of course, about the Jews, and, you know, although she didn't do it, I mean, Hitler and so on, she was really, these things made her extremely unhappy, you know, particularly as she, I mean, after Munich, we all felt absolutely emotionally shattered, because on the one hand, I mean, she was living in London with this young, deaf, adopted daughter and very elderly retainers in a rather vulnerable house, you know, and was everybody thought that the first thing that would happen would be that London would be absolutely flattened. See, I don't think people who haven't lived through it, who aren't old enough to remember that war, quite realize perhaps how sort of conditioned we were to the fear of bombing. We thought that, I mean, we hadn't sort of realized that anyone could go through terrific great bombings. Afterwards, people discovered that they could, I mean, and even survive, you know.
You're quite right.
At the time, it seemed so terrible that we couldn't help being thankful that it had been put off, because everybody who knew anything knew that we had no defenses and we were completely disarmed, you see. On the other hand, when we discovered what a sellout we made of Czechoslovakia, we were absolutely shattered. It was so terrible. It was dishonorable. And I mean, she felt that. She felt thankful she was able to go back to her house. She couldn't help being, because she was human. I mean, she'd been, so they'd all come down to us as we were living in the country.
In the Munich crisis,
yes. They were all quartered on us, and it was a terrible situation. And then a I'm so ashamed of having, you know, what had been done. It was really a horrible time.
You say, you said earlier, you were explaining how, in a sense, you feel maybe she might have been quite glad to get out of involvement in public affairs in the when she first took responsibility for you. But on the other hand, you said later that she always retained an interest in politics.
Yes, when I say out of public affairs, I only mean out of sort of things like sitting on committees and...
Yes.
Never out of her interest.
I see, yes. So she always, as you say, always read the newspapers, would she?
Well, yes, I'm sure she did all listen to, when after we had this little while, she would listen to the news, you know. She always knew what was going on.
Did she?
Yes.
And kept up with politics and public affairs.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Even though not particularly active in the women's movement as
yes.
such.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That's interesting. Because in a way, she's a rather romantic figure who goes back into the past a lot, and I wouldn't have thought that would be combined with a great interest in current affairs as well. The reason why it shouldn't be combined with it.
No, I think it was with her. I think it had been so, it had been a family tradition rather, because, you see, there are one or two letters, there's this letter about Dreyfus case, there's another letter I seem to remember about. No, I'll give you the little packet, you can have a promise if you'd like, because these are all yes. Which were written down to her mother or her grandfather or someone during the times when those things were happening. And I think it was there was this tremendous tradition of the public service. And although they were none of them actually civil servants, I mean they were in the armed forces.
I see.
They had this feeling of responsibility for the country as well as just for themselves and people around them.
Because again, it's something one needs to remember, that people were much more patriotic in a quite self-conscious way, weren't they?
Yes.
Everybody, not just the right,
yes.
but
yes, they
the
were.
Right and left.
Yes, yes, they were.
And one sort of just took it for granted in a way. I mean, I vaguely remember that myself.
Yes.
Whereas
yes.
now, you know, I mean, one's noticed that with the obituaries of Anthony Eden, I expect you've noticed, have you?
Yes.
Where people talk about his Patterson as being in some sense rather old-fashioned.
Yes, correct. Yes.
But it was something everyone quite unconsciously accepted then. But was she, would you say, I mean, if one looks at her qualifications for public life, was she a business-like person? Was she a good organiser? Was she good with paperwork?
I think possibly not. You see, I think perhaps that was one of the reasons why it was rather a failure when she temporarily entered the Common Court. I mean, I can't think of any other reason for that. Barbara won't tell me where. I think she thinks, she did say one time that Ray had very strong views about this, but she hasn't told me what they were. I know I got more or less sacked from it in a kind of polite way. You know. There's an absolutely marvellous passage in that diary which I remember when she says that Ray had painted such a ghastly picture of what it was like to enter the Common Court to me that I felt I must do it. This is absolutely characteristic of what you see. Characteristic of both. I mean, Ray was had a sort of practical common sense, thought that it would put her off, but of course had forgot to make allowances for her kind of terrific feeling for self-sacrifice and so on.
She was keen for self-sacrifice.
Oh, I think so. I mean,
yeah.
Selfishness was always considered to be terribly important.
Yeah.
And I think, there I think sometimes she deceived herself, although, there again, as you say, I mean, we're all human. I think when I look back, I can see that sometimes being unselfish was either unreasonable or it was really another way of getting what one really wanted.
Yes, yes. But one other thing that occurred, what do you think she would have done if she hadn't taken responsibility for you? What would she have risen? What would she have done?
Well, that's a point, you see, which I often wonder, because she would have written, undoubtedly, she would have done some, maybe, you see, she would have brought out women in subjection and then something else later. Whether she would have got the car, I dare say she would have got the Florence. I didn't quite know who chose her for last night to get out how it happened. I mean, that has thing that's, which just happened, and I knew it was happening, but I didn't know why it happened.
But there wasn't a sort of great project that was never completed as a result of having you.
No, I don't think so. Because, you see, I think in a way, you see, such a lot of her life had really been spent in sort of devotion to family duties. I mean, she'd escaped in a sense, I suppose, it was a sort of escape when she went to school, and then certainly when she went to LMH. You know, but the, even there, I mean, there was some having to go back. You know, I don't think she could do a situation with her problems very much what repeated itself with me later on. Is there were things one might have done in vacations with one's friends,
yes,
which just you couldn't do, but you had to go home to be
yes.
there.
Was this one of the things about women in those days? You know, and to some extent now, they just don't get the opportunities to concentrate on anything.
Their
lives parceled up into little
yes,
bits.
Yes. She was a much, I mean, why I could never have been to her, I mean, why I could never have taken up the torch, so to speak, from her, but she was, really had got a scholarly. I mean, she could sit down and do research and apply herself to it for hours, and they didn't, and absolutely love it, you know. And I've always been a much more person who disperses and serves a lot of different things. A lot of conflicting interests, and I'm not a really scholarly person. I think she really was. She had the makings of a scholar.
She was a single-minded one. She
yes,
could be single-minded.
She could be single-minded about that sort of thing.
So when she was reading or concentrating on it, she was somewhere else. She wasn't within.
Yeah, I think that's true, yes. And for that reason, of course, she could never have functioned under the sort of conditions that... I mean, in a sense, she had to have the kind of conditions that men had and still have in the academic world, you know, in order to be able to function. She had to have something, you know, for meals and things laid out and the house looked after and other things all around one to school to hear, but in order to be able to get down to it.
Yes.
I think that is true.
Yes. You don't feel that there was an overriding desire for achievement on her part? More sense of duty that leads her to do certain things at certain times. There's not an overriding purpose at all, necessarily. And very few of us have that, anyway.
Yeah, I think she felt that the world could be made better, you know, in a perhaps more hopeful way than any of us feel now. I mean, there was more at that time. I mean, there was more, I suppose, in a sense, there was the sort of inherited idea of progress was still going on with people, you know.
Even after the First World War.
Even after the First World War.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that is, I mean, if you look at the left now, for instance, the Labour Party, there is a lot of cynicism, a lot of negativeness, a lot of anti, feeling, which of course was used to be there, but not in quite the sour way.
Yeah. She was never cynical about anything. I mean, this was the outburst side of her, not always being totally realistic, you know, but she certainly was never cynical. I mean, I would say that she was very real and sincere and genuine, but as you say, a romantic. And the thing that she didn't really like was open admissions. I mean, there was a sort of sense in which she couldn't sort of, when she loved people, the best that she saw in them was so important and so overriding that she couldn't really, or at least she found it intensely difficult to admit the flaws, you know. And she didn't have this sort of thing of being able to sort of see the flaws and see things as they really were and accept it. And she was always fighting against anything bad. She was a great fighter, you see.
A very determined sort of person in a way, was she?
Yes, I mean, she was.
Not militant. You wouldn't think of her as militant in the sense of aggressive, in any sense.
Not at all aggressive, no, because she was too she left me with, that one really had to live up to her idea, because it would have distressed us. I never felt that she'd cast me off, or that,
no.
You know, I didn't feel she'd reject me, but I just felt that it would pain her.
But the word puritanical wouldn't come at all to mind in relation to her, would it?
No,
she's high principled, but it doesn't
yes.
lead to...
No, she wasn't puritanical, no, because she really enjoyed the good things of life, and if one could afford them, she would have had them. I mean, you know, she only would put things in her priorities.
I understand, yes. One other thing I did want to ask was about the WEA. Was she at all active in the WEA later, the Work and Education Association?
Well, I didn't really know about that, actually. It's just sort of, I don't think she could have been, because I would have known about it. What did she actually do for them?
Well, I can't remember. I simply read somewhere that she was connected with the WEA in her early years. That is before.
That was probably when she was living in Oxford.
Yes, would be.
Yes,
it would be. I just wondered if.
Now, that's a very characteristic sort of thing for her to
yes.
be doing, you know, something that she would have done in Oxford.
Did she have ideas about education, really, particularly? I mean, do you remember her being interested in education or having criticism of the way you were being taught? Did she leave it to the school or the school?
She left it to the school, right? No, I don't think she did. I mean, I think I don't remember her. She certainly didn't sort of read books about education or you know, she wasn't as interested in educational theories, I don't think. In spite of the fact that she had several friends who were...
Well, she's got so many. I'm
just wondering if she'd got some...
That's quite possible.
I think Roland was, actually. But I think it was all very sort of... you know, I mean, she accepted St. Paul's as a good school, and because I was happy there, and she thought I was being well taught. She realised that I wasn't getting what I needed at the school in Hampstead that we first went to.
That's not King Edward's, is it, all?
No, it was a school... it was called Frognall School, no, it is. I know, it was really just a small private school.
Mm. What about speaking, Mrs. Dunlop? Was she a good public speaker? Did she have a good voice? You say she was a tone, do you say tone deaf?
You know, I never heard her speak in public. Mm. I don't think, at least I can't remember her. She was very good at, I should think she had a sound, she was good at reading, I mean, she could control her voice, you know, although she was tone deaf, I mean, she was marvellous at reading aloud, and sort of rather dramatising the books.
Was she?
Yes. And she had she'd done a bit of amateur dramatics when she was a girl and enjoyed it very much.
And she had a nice voice, didn't she?
Yes, I think she did, really. It's, I suppose it's something that's been so familiar that I can't really
of course,
remember.
Of course, yes.
What it was like now.
Yeah.
I certainly used to enjoy, I mean, she was an indefatigable reader aloud. And we went through all sorts of childish illnesses, you know, and she used to read aloud for hours in the days when you... Princes and measles, you see, weren't allowed to read because your eyes were supposed to be. She agreed to us hours on end. She was very good at that. And of course, a lot of my education was really just the presence of 70 books in the house and always being read to all the time. Whatever the school hadn't done to me, it was supplemented quite well at home.
Again, just like Lady Stocks, I mean, her talking to her granddaughter, she said the first thing she remembered about Lady Stocks as a child was reading aloud, this marvellous reading aloud that went
yes.
on and with acting the parts and so on.
Yes.
Something again which I think probably has declined quite a lot. Presumably television is partly responsible
yes.
for that. A lack of literary background generally.
Yes, I think it has. It's sad really, because it was a marvellous part of family life. That.
Oh, absolutely. What about Scottish women's hospitals? Did she ever talk much about
them? No, she didn't talk about them. She had some sort of medal or something which she'd been given by them. I don't quite know what happened to it now. I remember finding it and saying, what on earth is this? And she was going to the Scottish women's hospitals. But she'd raised money for them. She always
yes,
did
I think so. Yeah.
I never really discovered what happened about them. That was probably, I should say, that was due to Mary Crumbine, because she was... This lady I mentioned who had been sort of more or less adopted and lived with them. It was Dale Beach with her. Because she had a sister, Isabel, who was a matron of an actual hospital in Scotland.
she have any sort of, we're talking about health really, did she have good health, would you say? Was she robust, so to speak?
Well, she was like so many people of that generation, really rather tough, but with a great many minor ailments, you know. And we were all, always having colds and inhaling or headaches and taking aspirin. And there was an awful lot of sort of self-medication going on in the family all the time.
But that wasn't unusual, particularly.
No, that was very common, yes. And I should say, basically, she was very strong. She had a strong heart. Because, I mean, her actual body made a tremendous fight against this cancer.
And so if one was ill, would one fight against it? Would there be little talk about if you were ill, you had to grin and bear it? Would there be that sort of one story?
No, they were not. She was rather soft, in a way, she was rather soft about illnesses. I mean, she'd been brought up, you see, her mother made her on a hobby of being ill, I think, and her grandfather to a certain extent. And so she was very sympathetic towards illness. And illness was made, I mean, just being unwell was made an excuse for all sorts of indulgences, you know, intolerances. And she was always worrying about our health. Well, there were reasons, but I mean, she was inclined to think that people were more delicate than they were.
Cats were simply just as a thing. She just loved cats.
She adored cats. She'd always been brought up with cats, and she liked that. You see, cats, in a way, were like babies. I mean, she liked something that was sort of soft and cuddly and prepared. And the cats were, they ruled the house. She was very, actually, she was very, this was another thing she had in common with the Hammonds. She was mad about anti-cruelty to animals altogether, you know. She was very keen about that, yes.
And anti-vivisection?
I don't know whether she actually, I think that she had sort of reluctantly admitted that some kinds of experiments on animals were necessary for the well-being of humans and even of animals, you know. I mean, she'd sort of thought it out logically, so to that extent it wasn't just emotional, you know. She was rational about it. But she was actually extremely pained by it. And that used to be a bit of a bore in what went abroad. Well, I was just as bad, really. I mean, we used to get ourselves very worked up about things like that. In fact, we had a sort of family joke about the cat on the roof, because there was one occasion when we were on the borders of France and Spain in the Pyrenees, and there was a cat on the roof which we'd made up our minds couldn't get down and starving. It had been there several days, you know, sort of living, you know, we'd always seen it when we came back. And finally she paid a man to go up on the roof and get it down. And the next day the cat was there again. After that, to leave it to its own devices, but it was the sort of family joke. The cat on the roof was about something, you know, people being very upset about. Something turned out to be.
Presumably, she didn't mind getting old at all. I mean, she aged, as they say, gracefully.
Yes, I think she did. I don't think she ever thought of herself as old or young or anything in that way. You know, she didn't sort of. She was very active. She still. Although she also had very rheumatic knees, she was much better at walking by the time she died, which is the age I am now, than I am, you know. So presumably either wasn't so bad or she was more able to cope.
Because one of the things about Ray Strange is, she said in her private correspondence, she's always saying, I just don't feel more than my early 20s. I just don't feel any different inside myself. Whatever the body was like, she still felt mentally young.
Yes.
And I wonder whether your mother, your aunt had a sort of youthfulness in mind like that at all.
I think she probably did. I doubt if she would have sort of talked about it much, you know.
No.
I think it just was something that, I don't know, I haven't really got the impression.
Because Ray was always bouncing, wasn't she? I mean.
Yes, she was. Yes, kind of didn't bounce.
By
the way, when you used the word mother, you were quite right in a sense, because now that was an English, perhaps I should have told you. At a certain period after she took us over, I think it was probably me and not my sister who took things much more for granted, but I was pondering over not having a mother, you know, and sort of feeling deprived and all. an Ida and talks about Mother Ida, you know. And I said to her, I think I'm going to call him Mother Ida, you know. So we then called her Mother Ida several months. Well, that was okay, you know, we called her Mother Ida for quite a long time. And then gradually either my sister or I began dropping the Ida. We just called her Mother, and of course she loved this really, because she always felt she really was our mother spiritually, you know. Because she had this thing about, you know, physical parenthood only being sort of, so to speak, an accident. Not really very important. But it caused her a certain amount of difficulty, because when we were going abroad, and she had these children calling her Mother, and she was Miss O'Malley, you see, and people used to look down her noses. So then she said she would call herself, provided that none of my uncles or her brother objected very strongly about it, she would call herself Mrs. O'Malley, from the point of view of booking hotel rooms and making arrangements for travelling and so on. And she did that, and she said that she was perfectly entitled to do that, because cooks always call themselves Mrs. And in the 18th century, anybody of a certain age was called Mrs. So why shouldn't she be? You see, this was fair enough. One or two relations did have very grave reservations about it. My uncles didn't mind. I mean, they said, oh, if she wants to do it, let her do it. You know, they did those things. But later on, it did cause me a certain amount of embarrassment, because whereas when we were much younger, it was quite, you know, people didn't know who we were, and she just was our mother, and we didn't have a father. I mean, he was presumably dead, you know, or away, like some people's fathers were. So that was okay. But I remember when I went to Oxford, I was being interviewed for St. Hugh's, getting terribly tied up with the principal who asked all sorts of questions about the family, you know, and trying to, didn't really mean to poorly, but she got me sort of blushing and hot under the collar. And then on another occasion, I met somebody who had been at St. Andrews with my aunt, you see, and who remembered her. And she said, well, what's she called now? And I said, she's called Mrs. O'Malley. And she said, well, that's extraordinary. She must have met a cousin or something. This was the sort of thing that did crop up a certain. And I felt obviously perhaps it had been a mistake. We should have stuck to aunt. And now in talking about it to the children, so of course I always refer to the relationship as correct, but for the whole of the time between the time when I was about 12 and the time I was growing up, I did call her Mother.
Did you? Yes. There is an argument for those, isn't there?
There is, yes. Definitely. That's one of the only really good things that I want to
do. Yes, I must say, I mean, yes. The trouble is that people who use MERS on the whole, when there's a lie...
It is a symbol, no, but I do tend to use that now, because
yes,
I think it's just good.
I think there is a case for it, certainly. Yes. One last question, really, simply, when the oxyacetylene welding ever sort of came up at all, I mean, that was something she did in the First World War. Again, presumably, you wouldn't have been involved in that or conscious of it. Well, if a lot of women were trained up during the First World War to do jobs men had previously done, and one of these was Ray Strange's, the London Society of Women's Service, oxyacetylene welding thing, which was organised by Barry Lowndes, I think. And she was involved in that. I was wondering whether that was ever...
Just the organisation,
I think. It must have been the organisation.
Yes, it must have been, yes. No, I never really heard about that.
Yes.
There were quite a lot of things that I didn't... I tell you another thing you ought to get hold of. During the time after she'd finished editing the Common Cause and she'd been thrown out, and when she had us with her, she wrote some articles. It was after it changed its name to the Women's Leader.
That's right, yes.
Yes. She wrote some articles, which you may not have spotted as hers, because I think they were anonymous, called The Diary of a Woman in the Home. Well, you might have a look at those, because they're quite interesting. I mean, that was the sort of period shortly after she'd given up public work in order to pay more attention to us. And one thing she did was writing these articles.
You know. I see, and that makes it... That is because she's involved in the home.
Yes.
What about St. Leonard's? Was that at all important? I mean, clearly it was a very important school. I just really wonder whether she ever talked about it, or whether you feel St. Leonard's was important.
Tim. Of course, she wasn't there quite as long as some people might have been. And she didn't go till she was 15. So she only had 3 years there, you know. But I suppose the being away from home was a big thing for her, you know. And she always talks about it as if she'd enjoyed being at school.
I see. Yes. I wonder whether when choosing St. Paul's and so on...
Well, it was very funny about St. Paul's, actually, because she really wanted me to go to Cheltenham Ladies' College for a bit. She'd thought of leaving London, of getting a house in Cheltenham where it might have been cheaper to live, and sending me there as a day girl. And I think this was because of Frieda Godfrey, who was influencing her a lot of the time. But we read the prospectuses of various schools, you know, and there was a thing about Cheltenham which said that you mightn't go home, you mustn't walk home with another girl unless there was permission given by both your parents. And I said, I'm not going to that school, whatever happens. And she quite agreed, which was perfectly ridiculous. And then she thought, then somebody else told her about support. It wouldn't be Mrs. Hubbard then, Mr. Diana came later. I don't know. Anyway, she had the prospectuses of a lot of schools, you know, and she was a bit worried that St. Paul's was a long journey.
It's a very good school at that time.
It is again nice. It went through a bad period after they had a lot of trouble just during and after the Second World War. Now it's a very good school again, I think, yes. I still receive the school magazine.
Mm-hmm. When you went to this Forster Society meeting, she was connected with the London Society for Women's Service, was she?
Yes, she was.
Did she go a lot to
that? Oh, she didn't. I mean, you see, that's how I've been a member. Society ever since those days, because as soon as I was old enough, she made me a member. And that was one of the places where we used to meet Pippa, because one Pippa was, you know, pretty busy.
Yes, that's where she'd be, and so you just meet her there. But she didn't sort of do anything much there, then she just went to meetings.
But I don't know whether she was on the executive for a bit. She may have been, I forget.
I think she was. She certainly was connected with it, yes. She was on the executive committee from 1911 to 13 and 1914 to 17. But I don't know what happened afterwards. The source I was using stopped.
Yes, well, I think maybe she was... I would say I didn't really know whether she was on the executive after it became the Fawcett Society.
I could easily find that out.
Yes. I think possibly not. I remember her talking about... some of what were then the young, I mean, for instance, Miss Halpin, you know,
the young councilee, what's it called, the council that used to be.
Yes, and she was there when it was a leading junior members.
Junior council.
I remember her telling me about them, with great approval, you know, but they've now, of course, become the old guard.
Yeah, I mean, well, of course, they've all got to, quite high positions. One last open-ended question. Is there anything about her that you'd like to bring out that we haven't brought out? I mean, any point about her? Because, you know, one always sort of has a sort of really rough shot at asking the right question. One doesn't any means always succeed. Is there anything that one ought to bring out about her we haven't mentioned?
Well, I think
we've had a really wide-ranging discussion of it.
She was very keen on France. I don't know, she was very good at French and read a great deal of French literature. She was very much more sympathetic to the Latin point of view than to the German, in spite of being a romantic. I mean, this was a kind of contradiction in a way. She never really liked the German language or the German people. I sometimes used to think that partly she wouldn't have been so anti-German if she hadn't been totally unmusical, you know, because she didn't have to meet them on that level, you know. But she was always, we didn't go to German, we tended not even to go to German-speaking parts of Switzerland. We went to Switzerland a great deal. She liked going to Switzerland very much because she always felt Switzerland was a very model sort of country, free and independent, so in spite of the Swiss being so anti-feminist. See, I think in those days she probably thought it was only just a little longer to wait, and she never realized that the Swiss would
That's interesting. And yet, of course, there's certainly a very strong idea in Germany, always has been, of the Frau, hasn't the little Frau.
Yes, well, you see, I think it's partly that. And partly she didn't like the sound of it, which she perhaps not enjoyed learning it when she was a child or so. She liked Italians, but she took against them with Mussolini, rather, you know. Only not wholly. I mean, she always felt that this was bad, and this was something bad thing they were going through, you know. But of course, she loved Italian paintings. I think she was more keen on the Dante and things like that.
Of course, Ray Strange, she had quite a connection with...
Yes, yes, yes. I don't think I'd ever stayed at... Well, she wouldn't, you see, she wouldn't have approved of Mrs. Baines.
They weren't... She got on well with Ray Strachey, did she? I mean, they were friends, were they?
They really were friends. Mm. They were very good friends.
And they had in common, well, feminism, I suppose, the enlightened attitudes to women's position, the running of children of roughly the same sort of age,
yes.
Same class position, cultivation.
Yes. Charlotte Young.
Yes. You mentioned reticence. That's another thing. Very interesting. How did you draw
from that? The
Jesuit Butler Society.
Yes, Jesuit Butler Society. She was quite keen on that.
But they do. That generation has a rather nice. I mean, if one compares it with the present day situation, the more publicity you can get, whether good or bad, the better on the whole for a large number of people. Whereas in that generation, it's almost the reverse at that social class level.
Well, I think it's good. I think the only thing is that there's a difference which people are doing between publicity and openness. I mean, I think that partly, you see, they... it is also partly a class thing, I think. I think one of the things that one's got to renounce in an open society is quite so much privacy. Everyone suddenly got used to doing with less of it.
I mean, I greatly welcome the change which enables you to talk as freely as you have about
yes.
your family affairs,
yes.
and not many people would do that now, mind you, but nonetheless, I welcome that aspect of modern
yes.
society. I think this makes things much better, but it's all accompanied by, they're not necessarily related to, this sort of pursuit of the media and pursuit of
yes, but of course I shouldn't have dreamt of doing you openly unless you had already said to me that you weren't going to publish things without
yes.
agreement. And because that is something that one must reserve.
Yes, oh, I think that's quite right.
But I think that it is, I do attach a great deal of importance myself to trying to find out and state the truth about people who are doing themselves.
I agree.
And, so that I think that certainly the reticence was overdone insofar as too much reticence of that sort tends to make people really be living in a slightly unreal world.
Yes, I agree. Do you think she or aunt was rather, as in another modern jargon phrase, a private person?
I think she was rather, because she had this terribly strong and also because of her loyalties, you see. I mean, she did put loyalty as a virtue more highly than I think I would. I mean, I don't think it isn't that I don't value loyalty, but I think it can be overvalued. And I think that partly her generation, partly her sort of education, partly her belonging to a service family and so on, all those things going together possibly made her overvalue loyalty to the extent of stress of not stressing perhaps another, you know, there's a large to truth which requires a certain kind of realistic approach to facts, which may sometimes involve being open about things which you don't like to know or wish never happened and so on.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, it's difficult.